All right, folks, we're back on the Flagstick.com T-Talk podcast. Stefan Tidorp here with my co-host, as per usual, Scott Cloud. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, man. Long time no talk.
Yeah, we didn't talk last week. You had a good interview last week. Top 100 courses.
Yeah,
must crazy, be nice. Eh? Must be nice, right? But hey, you know, everyone's got to do a job, and that's the job he had decided he was going
to
do.
Yeah, if people haven't listened to that, actually, yeah, just go back. Anthony Spagnoli was our guest last week. That's pretty evergreen content if you want to go back and have a listen. But the third person I found out that has finished the top 100 in Canada as per Score Golf Magazine. So cool, some cool content there, and maybe some aspiration for the rest of us, I guess.
How many do you think you've hit?
I've looked at the list. I haven't looked at the most current list. I think I'm probably in the 50s, I would think.
That's pretty good. 100. What about top 10? Like, so, I mean, currently,
I haven't even looked at it. So
I mean, it's just fun. I mean, we didn't plan to do this, at all. But for Score Golf, their top 10 here, let me just pull it up. I mean, hey, why not? Why not? I'm here. I'm talking. I'm just going to pull this up and see. Right. So you've been to Cabot, correct?
Yeah.
Correct. You played the National?
Correct.
Have you played Fairmount Jasper Park?
Of course I have.
St. George's?
Yes.
Cabot Lynx?
Yes.
Banff Springs Fairmount?
Yes.
Hamilton?
Yes.
Capilano?
No.
Oh.
Been there, but not played.
Cape Breton Highlands?
Of course.
And Devil's Paintbrush.
I played Pulpit on Monday.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we're 80% of the top 10. That's awesome. Yeah. So what's new? What's new in your world? I take it you're at this weird kind of season wrap up lessons, but also, you know, high school players probably really jamming up the schedule. So what's new? Give me a rundown.
It's been busy. I mean, we've had, as I mentioned, we had our golf journalist day last Monday. So got out and played at Devil's Pulpit. Then I had to whip back to Ottawa. So that's in Caledon, Ontario. Then I had to whip to Ottawa for 7:30 the next morning. So I left at 9:30 in Caledon, Ontario. And then, you know, several hundred kilometers later, I had to be at this other golf course, a Greyhawk, for our PGA of Ottawa Ping Challenge Cup, where the assistant pros take on the head pros. Unfortunately, I wasn't playing.
We were just being the captain, and
we were successful for the first time in 3 years. So that was good to see. But yeah, it's just been busy. You know, we still have a digital issue left to get out there. Still lots of things happening in the golf scene. So, getting ready for kind of the onslaught of new equipment. And then, as you mentioned, from the coaching side, a lot of people that are winding down, some people that are talking about, you know, getting ready for the winter time. And then the Ontario High School Championships are this week. So I was just doing some prep with some players in the last number of days for that. And that will wrap up most of the junior schedule for the year, thankfully. And then, you know, they'll take a little bit of a break, I think. Most of them will, and then get ready and start thinking about next year.
And then you got to deal with hacks like me all winter long.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know all too well the car. It took me about 6 hours to do a 3-hour drive yesterday. Oh. And I was on the good side of the highway. I was looking at the highway from Toronto to Belleville. My direction was slow.
Yeah,
the other direction towards Toronto. I've never seen it like that. No accidents.
No.
And literally from Toronto to Belleville yesterday, and we're recording this on the Tuesday after Thanksgiving, was just bumper to bumper. Like, it must have taken people 8 hours to do a 2-hour drive.
What time of day were you doing that?
Like middle day. I think we left Niagara area around, you know, 1 p.m. And like, yeah, it was just.
I will tell you, I was traveling probably a few hours before that, coming back from Peterborough to Kingston, Ontario, and it was the exact same way already. Like, it was just, I don't know whether people finally felt safe enough maybe to make some family trips and do some travel and stuff like that, but the volumes on the road were definitely a little bit crazy. Maybe people too are not, maybe they're not flying, or maybe they're not taking the train or whatever. So maybe more of them are hopping in cars, but whatever the case, it was a beautiful day and man, everybody was out. That's for sure.
Yeah. It's crazy. I think people are also getting back to normal. Like, I don't know about obviously you just kind of highlighted, you know, last year we, you had the Ontario's, sorry, the Golf Journalists Association, you know, golf tournament last year, but yeah, there wasn't really of the after party stuff and the dinner and all that type of stuff. It was more of a play, get together, do everything outside. Right. Yeah. Where now this year it's inside, like people are getting back to kind of in-person work stuff. I got to go to Toronto a few weeks to get back in person and do some work stuff. So I think everyone's kind of, it is weird. It's going to be very weird, but everyone's getting back. I'm going to the Leafs game on Thursday to a full barn in Ottawa. Like that's going to be weird. Like there's,
It's I went to a Queens football game on Friday, you know, university football here in Canada. And it was great. It wasn't busy at all because a lot of people were away for the Thanksgiving weekend, but certainly going to see live sports, you know, granted, obviously there's a lot of protocols to get in, fill out screening forms online. Everybody has to be double vaccinated, masks, spacing and so forth. But just great to kind of see it live again. It's just weird is really what it amounts to. So I'm sure we'll get over that as time goes, just as we have everything else, you know, we've adapted to it, but certainly interesting times for sure.
Yeah, I'm going to, like, there's actually the Honest Heart Collective, who we've had at the start of our podcast quite a few times. They've donated their music to us. They're playing in Kingston coming up, so I'm going to be checking out that at the end of the month, trying to see if I can get you out as well. We'll see if the old man is allowed out past 9 on a school night. We'll see. But yeah, it's going to be weird. That I don't know. I'm really excited for Thursday. I might be quite emotional just being in that building after 2 years of nothing.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of tears usually involved when you're talking about the league.
Yeah, good one.
That's you're good. Hoping these are good ones.
That's good. You know, there's a lot of tears in a lot of things right now. My golf game is at a point of almost tears. I don't know what's going on, but like, I know I've been talking about it all year. Yeah. Where, like, you know, I've made jokes. Like, I thought I was supposed to play better. Like, I get over, I don't feel like I have any idea what I'm doing anymore. And then I go to the range 2 days later and it's like, oh, I find this one little swing thought and then everything's good. But then you go play. It's like, so I don't know.
I think it's frustrating. You've texted me about that. And I was actually chatting with your dad yesterday. I ran across him in the driving range and, you know, he said, oh, I'm not sure what he's thinking about his game or whatever. And I'm like, the problem is that, you know, if you just chase a thought every single time, it's not going to work. Like, it just, you know, I get it. You know, you're trying to get a feeling for what you want to do, but, you know, you always got to have the basics in there and build it from the ground up. And, you know, it looks like we'll be doing that this winter and maybe we can get you back on the right foot so that, you know, permanently you can be thinking confidently about your golf game.
Yeah. Like my top of my head, I need a full rebuild from the ground up. I need, you know, and I'm willing to go to Turkey for the top of my head, full, you know, get the hair completely done again. And I'm willing to go across town multiple times a week to you to get the game from the ground up. Other news and notes. I went over to Hamilton Golf and Country Club over the weekend, visited our boy Brad, gave me a tour of the updates they're doing there. And like it is crazy. I walked around that golf course, obviously, you know, carrying a bag of the Canadian Open. And then it was 2 years ago. Right. And it's like, you know, he's pointing out things like the first hole. He's like, yeah, like it looks a lot different. Right. And I'm like, yeah, it kind of like this move. He's like, no, they moved the green 30 yards over here. And I'm like, oh yeah. Like, you know, it's crazy.
How good was your caddying if you didn't even know where the green was?
I was joking with him. I was like, you're giving me the tour, but
right,
Scott's the guy that you need to be given this tour, where like the littlest details, you would remember more things. You have like a picture memory of some sort. It's insane that Brad wouldn't even notice, and he's worked there for what, a year and a half, right? So it's awesome. It looks great. Everyone out there's so nice too, right? Like we walk around the members, you know, he's driving around and members.
It's
so
a great
nice.
Club. It really is a great club.
Great club, beautiful. I was joking with him, you know, like, hey, you don't mind if I sneak out on a holiday weekend? And then he starts making fun of me with the members in the club, and I'm already wearing a hoodie, which I didn't realize I wasn't supposed to. So I might be banned from that place at this point. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the work there that they've done. You know, there's been a couple of stories about it. Brent Long, who does some of their PR, shared some of the photos as they worked and did the process. So, it's going to be good. I'm sure of it, and I'm eager to get back and play it.
Now, we'll get to the week that was, but, you know, just talking about Brad quickly, he gets brought up a lot on this podcast. And I think he had a pole. So he made, there's a short course at Hamilton. Looks really cool. It's a little par three course, very short course.
Where you go with this,
I think
one.
It goes like 50 to like 90 yards. I think maybe if you play the back tees, it might get to like 125, something like that. Yeah. Very short. Now he made a hole in one on the short course from 50 yards.
Yeah.
Is it a hole in one? It's his first ever. It's his first ever. Do we call that a hole in one?
I saw his post and realistically, I was like, and I didn't know how to respond. I was actually had to think about it because you know what? You know, during a round of golf, yeah, I guess so. Is it a hole out or, but is it a hole in one? I mean, you know, if you're all of a sudden have 25 yard holes, is that, you know, is that too short? Like, where's the threshold where you get to a length where you kind of respect it? I guess technically, you know, it's a hole in one, but you know, it should be a hole in one for kids, really. Not for, although Brad's a kid, like, but yeah. I don't know. What are your thoughts on it? I'm still 50-50 on it.
I said give it to him. Why not? Why not? I it's on a golf course, I guess. It's
I guess. Not a, it's not he's a gonna be he's gonna be the one that's gonna have the plaque that says, "Oh, how long was your hole in one? 50 yards, 150
that,
feet."
See that I think that should be it. There should be a rule behind it. If it's under. If it's on a par three course, you have to get the plaque. It has to have the yardage exactly that day. So like even to the half. So it's, and you have to have it in your house for the rest of your life. So people can make funny, like 48 and a half yards was the actual yardage that day. Something along those lines. And then I'll give it to you. I think it's funny.
I think over the years, I mean, if I think about it, you know, I've had a few that are at pitch and putts and I've never counted those. I never thought about those. I mean, I always thought of it being on a regulation golf course and I've only had one of those. So
I think there's, to be honest with you, it's probably not
debatable.
But what about just quickly, what about like an executive course, like a par four and three course? I think like some people say those don't count. I think those count. Why wouldn't those count?
Again,
just because you have more opportunities,
I guess. I don't know. I guess you have to think of a, you know, what are the standards on that? I mean, I used to laugh because we used to, I used to have a golf store and one of our locations for the store was at an aquatic driving range. And you're familiar with this range. And we used to sit there and my partner and I had a hole in one contest back and forth to this one island that was like 67 yards and literally it was a slope green, so if you hit it in the right spot balls would roll in, and we hit thousands of balls there, and it literally I think our totals were, you know, in the 5-6 dozens each over the years of getting them in there. But and then people like, oh yeah, you've got hole in one. They're not hole in ones, they're practice shots, that's for sure. So
that's funny.
I don't know what the threshold is. I don't know what the, I mean, there's probably some official threshold for some hole in one society.
But, I think at the end of the day, it's up to you, right? Nobody, yeah, just like nobody cares what you shot. Nobody cares
if we get a hole in one.
Yeah, so
you're right. 100%.
Do what you want. All right, let's hit the week that was, Scotty.
Sure.
Where we give a birdie, a par, a bogey, and an honorable mention score to whatever we want for the week. Scott and I, prior to this, kind of. We'll get into it and not lie to all of you. We didn't watch much golf this weekend. It was a big weekend of turkey and family and football, basically, for me and you, it sounds like. So we're probably not going to talk too much about it to say we can break down shot by shot, but we're going to talk about the week that was. So, Scotty, where do you want to start this week?
You know what? Let's start with a birdie, and I want to start with yours because that was a story that really caught my attention. It caught the world's attention really on a social media side of it within golf, and I think it's a cool aspect of the game.
Yeah, so my birdie of the week, and it, you know what, we'll give it a hole in one on any type of course if we really want to.
Exactly.
It goes to Bluevale Collegiate Institute out of Waterloo, Ontario. This
what
school,
did you say? Collegiate? What? Collegiate?
What collegiate is what I meant to say. I said collegiate, I think. I don't know
what you're doing.
Collegiate
there.
Is what I meant to say. It's
sorry.
It is what it is. No, I'm glad you did, because then I was able to balance it. Maybe I'm dyslexic and you just made fun of me and now I got to talk to my therapist, but
my
I don't
apologies.
Know. But yes, Bluevale Collegiate Institute. They won a high school golf tournament last week. They didn't actually take the championship and decided to concede this tournament. There was a high school player on the Waterloo Oxford District Secondary School team that was 19. Because he's 19, he's ineligible to compete in this high school tournament. But the reason why he was competing in this high school tournament as an ineligible player was last year he missed the entire year due to cancer treatment. He played extremely well, and if they actually counted his efforts for the tournament, they actually would have won the tournament. So Blue Veil decided, you know what, that's how, like, let's do the right thing here. This kid shouldn't be punished because he had cancer. You know, let's look at the full context here, and decided to disqualify themselves from the tournament, allowing Waterloo Oxford to win. Just an awesome thing to see. I mean, I'm sure this happens elsewhere, but this feels like Canada to me in a lot of ways. Yeah. Like, there's competition, there's golf, but let's do the right thing here. So shout out to that team. Shout out to the player, Zach Hart, who went through cancer last year.
Great player, by the way. He won a Maple Leaf Junior Tour National Championship when he was 18 a couple years ago. So yeah, you know, he's an impressive player, and obviously he's had to, you know, deal with cancer, and he's become quite an advocate within the community, raising awareness about, you know, cancer and dealing with it. And, you're right. I mean, this is a great thing for that team, from Blue Veil to do, and deservedly so. They're getting the recognition that they probably were not even seeking. You know, they just wanted to do the right thing, which is cool.
Yeah, I think the coolest part about this is, and we're talking about 18-year-old, 17-year-old boys, right, who are very competitive and not necessarily forward-thinking a lot of the time. But the best thing about this wasn't a coach-inspired thing. This was a players-inspired thing. And I think the quote they say here is, "This doesn't feel right. Can we just forfeit and let them win somehow?" You know, there's things that are bigger than golf. Nobody's going to remember winning this high school tournament as a golfer from the Blue Veil side. But I can tell you that Zach Hart and the Waterloo team will remember it. So that's a birdie, an eagle, hole in one, and everything in between for me this week.
Yeah, big win for sure. I'll definitely reiterate that. Amazing. As you said, not always forward thinking at that age, and realizing that, you know, this meant more than golf itself, but you know, golf is still the glue that kept these you know, keeps these kids together. So it just shows what fine young men they are, and you know, there's some great people within the golf community.
100%. Hopefully Ryan goes on to have a, you know, a great, wait, I called him Ryan, I'm saying Reinhardt. Zach goes on to have a full golf career here.
Yeah.
And cancer's behind him. What's your birdie for the week?
Yeah, my birdie this week, you know what, she was a birdie recently for me as well, but Jin Young Ko, who got her 10th win, and you know what, not just her 10th LPGA Tour win, that's not why I'm giving her the birdie, although that's pretty significant, and it's her third this season, but 14 rounds in a row in the 60s, which tied a mark by Annika Sorenstam.
I would take 14 rounds in a row in the 80s at this point in my life.
Yeah.
Like, they're just unbelievable.
Yeah, and you know, that's very hard to do. I mean, any golfer will tell you to have a high level of consistency and, you know, have performance over a long period of time is very difficult to do. I mean, players will always tend to sprinkle in one round that's not great, but to do it for 14 rounds in a row just shows how impressive she is. And yeah, that's a big birdie for me. And I also, you know, at the same time, it was interesting when I was looking through her golf bag and what she currently plays. Here's another birdie for her as well, for playing the equipment that is best for her and not necessarily going with just a single brand. And she basically has a Titleist driver. She has fairway woods from Callaway, a hybrid from Titleist, irons from Bridgestone, ping wedges, and a Scotty Cameron putter. So a great lesson there for all golfers: get the stuff in your bag that will maybe help you have consistency and perform well. Don't necessarily just go buy a brand itself.
Yeah. So speaking of Titleist, some of my new irons are trickling in. I say some of them because I'm doing a combo set in them. They don't all match because that's what's best for me. I can't hit like a, you know, a lower handy. I probably can't hit them in the lower irons either, clearly, right now. But I can't hit like the T100S iron in the 4 and 5 iron at the right loft. So you get the 4 and 5 of the T200, right? Nice. Those are the things. Like, she has steel fiber iron shafts in there, which are like a graphite shaft, but in her wedges, she does not, like, things along those lines that people don't think about because everything needs to match and my head covers all need to match. Doesn't matter. We've done this so much. People, like, just get what's best for you. Go see a fitter, get it done. But yeah, I thought that was cool. I'm glad you usually post a lot of these in our notes when we're doing these of like the what's in the bag and nothing really pops out. But when I saw this one, I was like, ah, interesting. Love to see that.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, kudos to her. Birdies all around for Jin Young Ko, and hopefully continued success for her.
Yeah, this gets me back when I keep seeing that. Like right now, I think we're getting very close to finally getting a full tournament with the PGA and the LPGA, just because like there's these stars on both sides and we need them to play in a tournament. I want to know what Jin Young Ko does against a John Rahm. I want to know what Nelly Korda does against not playing very well right now against a Rory McIlroy, for example, right? Like let's put best against the best. Let's do a tournament. Like why can't we have 10 tournaments a year where that week they combine with each other? And it just be like, if there's a partnership, let's make it happen. I know it might be limited fields and maybe your alternate event, maybe you have an alternate event that is less of a purse and it's the same thing. I don't know, but I'd be interested.
Yeah, I think I'd be interested in that for sure. I mean, if you look at us within the PGA of Canada, we actually have an arrangement that's in there that if a female player plays in what is designated as a men's event, they play at 87% of the yardage. So why wouldn't that work at another level? I get it. Sometimes there's some different difference in conditioning as far as the, you know, how the courses are set up and prepared, but I'd love to see, an LPGA tour player like Jin Young Ko set up at 87% of the PGA tour courses and see what happens.
Yeah. I think I feel like we're getting close. I have no sources here. So somebody gave me a message recently and I'm not naming them, but they said sources are saying Zach Johnson or Freddie Couples for the next Ryder Cup. And you know who I'm cheering for that. So I have sources for some things, but I don't have any sources for this tournament actually happening, but hopefully it does. I would kill for a Ryder Cup style where it is mixed, but I'll just give me a tour event at a TPC course right now. I'll throw that in my veins.
I'd rather see that than the match they're on.
We're not talking about that,
but yeah, you know what I'm saying.
No, I will give it a birdie for it being 12 holes. That's
just so it's over.
Just so it's over. And also I'm kind of into 12 holes of golf. Nine's not enough. And 12 is like, tell me I'm wrong. Like,
yeah, but you want 12 in a different way. You want to play 18 and throw out six, right?
Well, no, I just want to play 12 and then throw out six still. And then I like, hey, it's six holes. Yeah. Like 12, like, maybe like I need a golf course where after every six holes it ends up right at the clubhouse, so you have those options, you know, like and
Bunker Hill in up in the Durham region. They have a 12 hole course. It's six and six, so you can actually stop after six or continue after 12 and play 18.
Oh, genius! I love that, and I would be stopping after six or 12. There's never a chance I'm getting through 18. We're getting off track. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to hit my par for the week. And I'm glad you're here for this because I need your thoughts. So you are a PGA professional. And I've ran into three or four within the last month, maybe five. And every time I ask this question, I always get the same answer. And it's been like this forever. And it's like, hey, have you been playing much golf? And it's always like, nope. But it's almost there's like, maybe I'm coming out
like a badge of honor that they're not playing.
Yes. There's like this badge of honor there.
Yeah.
And it makes me think, is it because I'm so focused on my craft, which is now not my golf game. It's making other people's golf game better. Or is it that like, I don't care to play golf. And that's like a whole other thing where I was getting after a couple caddies recently where it's like, they were posting, like, oh, don't need to hit any more golf shots for the year. Got my three in. Shout out to Dez who posted that on his tournament. Like, so I'm not going to go down that alley of like the caddy side of things, because I can tell you from being there, it's a whole other world where you're just exhausted. But like, is this an issue? Is it that they're focused on the craft? Is it this pride? Like, is it a bad thing that they don't, if they didn't want to play golf? Or should these people be like, should we actually be making PGA professionals, like maybe there's a day a week where that's focused, where they actually just go and play golf with their members at the golf course they're at. And it's part of like, I don't know. I don't know how I feel. That's why it's a par, but like, when I get that question, it doesn't make me feel good when I ask a PGA professional, hey, you've been playing golf much? And it's like this, nope, like this prideful, nope, oh, I've probably been out a handful of times this year. So I need your thoughts, Scott, because it's a par, but I'm turning it into a mailbag question at the same time for you.
Yeah, that's a big one. And obviously it's a topic that gets discussed a fair bit. A couple of elements, obviously this year and last year, slightly different just because of shortage in staffing at most golf courses, because they're busier as well. The guys are exhausted. Girls are exhausted. The pros of the club, the last thing they want to do is spend another hour at the golf course. In a lot of cases, they want to leave and go home. In other senses, some of them don't want to hang around their club. You know, they just don't want to hear another complaint and, you know, they want to bail and they'll go play golf someplace else. The other side of it too, is that progressively, the business has required the PGA professionals to spend more time in the club, to do more administrative duties. And unfortunately, that is taken away from the contact point that golf does provide. So realistically, if I was at a golf course and I was making a job description out for the pro, I would require them to play some golf, to interact with the members, to get out and play, to show their skills. You know, we have PGA professionals that don't teach, they don't even do anything. So they do one aspect of the job and, you know, that's it. So should they play? Yeah, probably they should. I mean, you know, I think there's a real situation in a lot of clubs where, members don't even know the pro. Because they're not playing, they're hidden away in their office doing things. They might get to see the assistant or whatever, but I think it's an important aspect of the game. I also think too, you know, a lot of times clubs put somebody who's really skilled, a PGA professional who's gone through the apprenticeship program, you know, that's minimum, you know, 4 years up to seven for them to qualify. And all of a sudden they tuck them behind the counter selling a shirt. There's other staff and other people that could be put in that position. I think the real value of a PGA professional is to make use of their talents and skills and their education to get them out on the golf course, to get them out on the teaching tee, to help promote the game. And you take the other tasks that are not necessary to have the person that's skilled in the way they are and assign that to somebody else. So I think it's a problem as well. Is there a solution for it? It's individual, it's course by course. But yeah, I would love to see more PGA professionals out playing more golf, as much for the club, as much for them as well, to keep them in touch with the game and their own mental health and their own well-being. And the fact that, you know, they came to this game because they love the game, and then you don't want them to lose that.
I think the other thing to say with it too, is even if you haven't, because, you know, You say you actually aren't even interested in play, right? You are still in customer service in a little bit of ways. And maybe the answers I get are because of a personal relationship where they're giving me an honest answer. But like, I remember the same thing when I didn't really have that. You'd ask somebody that question and nope. And like that badge of honor, like maybe switch it up. You know, yeah, I really wish I could. Just the lesson T's been demanding right now. So I've just been really working on teaching others so they can play golf, right? Like, much better answer than just this prideful, no, I don't play. You know, the old CPGA, can't play golf anymore. That's not what we got rid of that, right? From what I remember. What's your par for the week?
My par for the week is fall golf in general. I mean, we're obviously getting to the time of year here where we are, where, you know what, it's glorious out. The weather's been good. The settings are really good. I know when we got out a couple of weeks ago, you know, it was a really nice day.
What a weekend we had.
It was gorgeous. 20
degrees. I was in shorts.
Yeah.
Like which playing is golf in October. Usually around here, you got the mitts on in between holes.
And people were excited. I mean, the courses were packed for sure. I snuck out on a Friday and got some holes in, and it was great out. But the problem I always have this time of year was I'm always excited about fall golf and the fact that maybe I have a few less responsibilities and have some chance to play a little bit more, which, you know, we're just talking about. But on the other side, I know it's a countdown. And I think this has been a little bit more difficult in the COVID years, just because the fact of, you know, I'm not going away as much in the wintertime. whereas I can always look forward to that. But so for me, it's sort of both sides of it. I'm excited to get out there and play because it's, you know, seems like a bonus. On the other side of it, I also see this big clock ticking, knowing that, you know, just like our friends out in Alberta, all of a sudden -7 and snow, and, you know, when's that going to happen for us? So that's what makes it a par for me.
Yeah, I feel that. And it sucks not having that trip to look forward to, right? Like, I really wanted to go down to like Arizona or something this year again, but it's like, I mean, I'm not going political or whatever, but golf isn't worth what I potentially could be getting myself into
there. Yeah, you've got a young family and a young child, and, you know, you have to weigh the risks and, you know, rounds of golf versus something else. Yeah, you know, you'll just stay at home and enjoy it and wait it out like the rest.
Exactly. So hopefully you get back where we have those fall trips or winter trips to hold us off. My bogey for the week is these photos of Tiger Woods surfacing and everyone retweeting it and let's go, whatever, whatever. If Tiger Woods posts a video of himself on the range, or let's say he was on the range himself playing golf, share the photos. He's a celebrity, whatever. He's a golfer. Like, it's a good thing. You know, I would assume he's at a golf club where no one's going to do that because, you know, hey, that's Tiger. We don't screw around with him at this golf club.
Sure.
He's honoring. Privacy. Yeah. He's honoring us being a member here. He'd be a member anywhere. Right. But these photos surface and they always just give this weird taste in my mouth when it's involving Charlie. Charlie had a golf tournament. Tiger was there, not caddying, obviously.
Taken from a distance
behind the bushes.
We've been down this road before.
Oh, we always are. We always will be with him. And it just, I mean, I get it. Content is content, gets people talking, people get fired up. But I saw some very reputable media members retweeting it and talking about it, and none in that like, hey, we don't need to do this way. It was all like, oh, like, so we're close to a return. Like,
yeah,
it's I don't like it. I'm not giving
it. Let's get some likes and hits out of it. Let's milk it for as much as we can.
I'm not giving it an honorable mention, like a withdraw, like I usually would, because I get why it happens and it's gonna happen. That's just the world we live in, and now I'm old man yelling at clouds here, but but it's just a bogey. I don't think we need to dive into it. I'm happy standing, you know, they didn't see any crutches and everything, and hopefully the legs coming back. And you know what, I think it will be the best thing ever if he, I think the next time we potentially are going to see him will be at Augusta if we see him. And will that be, you know, the build up to that? Yeah. I want to see all the shots. I want to see if it's his golf swing from a distance, from the bushes, leading up to Augusta, go for that. That's awesome. But when you bring in a kid involved and, you know, he's just trying to be a dad, and, you know, none of the other dads that are bugging him, like, we don't need to share that all over Twitter.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. And, you know, I get it from a journalistic standpoint. You can report it, although I don't know if it's that newsworthy, really. But, you know, go ahead and report it. But just, you know, repeating the photo and sending it out and then speculating based on that. You know what? If he decides to come back, help yourself. But, you know, to sit there and go, come on, you know, he's going to be back here and he's going to be playing this. And, geez, you know, he's going to win the Masters. And, whoa, just settle down here. He's lucky to be alive.
Yeah.
Lucky to be alive and there for his family and there to enjoy the time with Charlie. So just take it for what it is.
Everyone wants a modern day Ben Hogan story, right? Like, exactly. Come on. But
just don't milk his story, the crap out of it. Really, just don't milk the crap out of it. And you'll notice I did not retweet it.
That's you never would. Cool. What's your bogey for the week?
Bogey for the week for me, reportedly the Players Championship, according to the Golf Channel, the purse is going to go up to $20 million, which is insane. It really is starting to get crazy. The thing is, why this is a bogey for me is that it just seems to be that the top part of the game gets heavier and heavier and heavier. And I'm all good with, you know, the top players in the game getting rewarded. But the problem is that we still have a system that has some of the best professionals in the world scrambling to make a living. And we're starting to see, you know, we see players
that think make a living is the right word.
No, I know. Right. Point. But
it's like, but they stay run, alive to be able
stay
to
stay alive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what happens is that I think we're missing out on a lot of great talent. And, the best way to make this make professional golf better is by allowing players that are developing to have the opportunity to stay around long enough that they can work to the top tiers of the game. And unfortunately, when you're playing on the McKenzie Tour, PGA Tour, Latino America, Corn Ferry Tour, you know what? The money's going to run out before the talent does in a lot of cases. And I get it. You know, if a player has hung around for a while and hasn't made it, you know, they haven't made it. I'm not talking about a system here that just, you know, gets people to hang around and you know, play mundane and make a living. We're talking good quality players that are not able to make a living. And, you know, if we want the tour to be as competitive as possible and top echelon golf to be possible, there has to be an opportunity for that development phase to happen. And I'd still love to see the tours at a lower level. And I know how they run their tours as far as top to bottom, but I'd still like to see bigger purses for the lower bottom tier tours. Yes, we don't want those players staying on there. We want them moving their way up, but at least make it somewhat reasonable for, you know, a few players to make some profit at the lower level, so they'll stick around instead of turning their back on it. And unfortunately, we all miss as golf fans when, you know, great players all of a sudden turn their back on it and they're gone, when, you know, they just need the time and the ability to be able to stay out there and make a living to eventually get themselves to the big stage.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it here. The $5 million increase could go into the Corn Ferry Tour season, yeah, which would be way stronger. Like, that would help a lot. That goes a long way.
I know it could double the purses on the McKenzie Tour. Double.
Right? Like, at least there, like, there, if you're a top tier member on the Corn Ferry Tour, you're making a living. Even if you're not getting your PGA Tour card, it's not a glamorous life. You're not, you know, flying private jets, but you do it right. You're putting food on the table. You're probably clearing, you know, with sponsorships. You're probably making, let's say, $65,000 a year. Let's call it that. Why not?
Sure.
Right? Say, like, you're in that 25 to 50. I don't know. I'd have to actually look at it. I could be talking on my ass right now for all I know. But you know what I mean, right? Like, if you throw that extra $5 million in there, right, like, that would help those guys a lot, where you could create a life in the United States for you and your family. You wouldn't have to go over, say, play in Europe as an American or as a Canadian and feel like, hey, I can be home. My wife can have a job. I work by playing golf. Sure. Whatever. Doing that for the Canadian tour, the top five on the Canadian tour, they still don't really make money unless you have like a Joel Damon like season where you win what, three times or whatever he did out there. I know he won two and was like, you know what I mean? You're still losing a lot of money with flights and everything like that. You're still probably not actually making money, if not breaking even. So you double the purse out in the Canadian tour by doing that. Well, hey, guys actually can make a living. So I agree with you. I think it is a bogey. The guys aren't going to notice that difference of that $5 million on the PGA tour, because the guys that are in there are the best playing guys in the world right now, that they already have money already. So they don't.
And the thing is, there's two elements. I know they're obviously trying to, you know, hold off other potential rivals for the PGA tour. On the other side as well, these are things that are all, you know, the player advisory council, these are approving. This is their tour. So, you know, for the top guys, just to be rewarding the top guys, I don't know. I get it to a point. You know, they need their purse to kind of be increasing, but at the same time, you know, don't forget the guys or the players that are coming up. You know, that's necessary. I mean, I looked at the Symetra Tour this week, and I get it. The LPGA is having a hard time getting enough money as it is right now, but man, I just look at the money that they're not winning for playing a full season on the Symetra Tour. And, you know, this is not about, you know, being hungry enough to work their way up onto the LPGA Tour. This is about, okay, do I have to go get a second and a third job, you know, between tournaments, just so I can stick around and play golf? And it's a shame, because as I said, you know, we see super talented players that, you know, don't have that time, and they need time. You know, the tour and professional golf is not a matter of an instant click. You know, you go from, you know, playing college golf to being a tour winner. It's a rare circumstance when that happens. They need time to develop, and they only get that time to develop right now, courtesy of sponsorship support more than anything, and not for being rewarded for what they're doing on the golf course, which is what they need to be doing, being rewarded there.
I mean, quickly, just shout out to Again, I'm going to botch her name, so I'm going to let you do it, from the Symetra Tour, who is now graduating to the PGA Tour. Maud Amy LeBlanc.
Yeah, Maud Amy.
From Sherbrooke, Quebec, Canada. She, you know, as we talked about 2 years ago, and that's crazy, 2 years ago on this podcast, we talked about her retiring. And now we are talking about her now going back to the LPGA Tour. So that's just awesome. So shout out to her. That's a birdie for me. No, you nailed it on that front. But hey, the PGA, the top, the rich get richer.
Yeah.
And the poor keep on fighting, I guess. And hey, whatever. I'm not going to get into it. It's never going to change. They're never going to drop $5 million into these lower tier tours when it could go into the pockets of the guys on the big tour. So we'll leave it at that. I'm going to hit my honorable mention. So will you. Mine for the week is just another par. And I've never given a second par, I don't think. But I'm giving a second par to Phil Mickelson winning on the Champions Tour. And the reason why I'm giving it a par is he's just at this weird crossroads, right? And like, it's like, do we really want to sell it? Like, it feels like this guy going out there and bullying. Like, it feels like, you know, that giant kid that like plays hockey that's like already 6 feet at 12 and all the other kids are like 5 feet and they're allowed to hit. That's what it feels like when Phil's out there, where it's like, oh, good for him. He put up another win, but like,
shocking.
He can't, like, he's just in this weird mix where he's too good for the Champions Tour and he's just like barely can get it done on the PGA Tour right now. And I know he's the PGA champion and he's going to be at the next five of them, right? He's going to be at the next 5 years of majors across the board.
This is his only top 10 of the year.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just like this par was like, cool. I didn't watch it. I don't know if it was exciting. I don't know anything. It's just, I don't know how to feel about Phil. I just really don't. When he wasn't on the Ryder Cup team, I thought, okay, this is the beginning to the end. That was his swan song when he won the PGA Championship. And I do believe it was, right? I always believed he'd get one more. I was always saying it would be the Masters. I didn't think be the PGA Championship. But here we are. I just don't know how to feel. So I'm just giving it a par. Good for you for winning. But
I wonder what it feels like for him. Like, does he feel like he's just going out there and, as you said, being the 6'2", 12-year-old, you know, crunching everybody into the corners or whatever. But I mean, at some time, you know, yes, it's a win, but does it feel like a false victory, or does it feel, I mean, yeah, you've got,
I mean, winning's hard anywhere, right?
Of
like,
course. Yeah.
Phil could go out, like, that's the thing. Like, the Champions Tour, it is what it is, right? But like, you could put Phil and bring him to, like, say, the Mackenzie Tour event that just happened 2 weeks ago. There's no guarantee to go out and win that thing, right? Like, he would be the favorite, I'm sure. But you know what I mean? Like, a lot of those players could have beat him that week. Winning is very difficult, but it just feels weird on the Champions Tour.
But that's the problem. That's why it becomes a par, is because he is in that middle ground. It's not one way or the other, whether he's, you know, out there dominating. And yeah, anyways, I know exactly what you're saying. That if there is a par, that is definitely
one. All right, what's your final honorable mention, final score for the week that was
in our interview? Mine's going to be a birdie in my honorable mention. And as I said, I was out at the Golf Journalists Association of Canada day last Monday. And a couple of things happened during that day. I got paired up with the chief sport officer for Golf Canada, Kevin Blue. This guy played golf for Stanford and, you know, went on to be an assistant athletic director and in university NCAA down south. Smart guy. Was a great hire when they brought him up for Golf Canada, and we happened to get paired together. And it was interesting because we had lots of good discussions about high performance golf in Canada. And this is a guy who takes his job very seriously, as he should. He's done a lot of analytics work. He's done a lot of studying. He's, you know, it's stuff that he will share with us on this podcast at some point. We did discuss that on the way. And you know what? This guy can still play. And he realizes that we're not in the spot that we need to be in Canada for golf. And especially at a professional level and a development level all the way down. And he's not shy about saying that. And he's looking at it in comparison to, you know, other countries in the world. And, you know, big birdie for him for being really honest about looking at this stuff and not just getting caught up in the glory of some things that are happening. The fact that we have a lot of players on the PGA Tour and we have, you know, Brooke Henderson winning on the LPGA Tour. He's giving this a really hard look. And at the same time, the president for Golf Canada, Liz Hoffman, came and had a chat with me. And we talked a little bit about, you know, golf in the country and things that we need to do to push forward. And man, it was an honest conversation, very good conversation. The fact that it left me with a lot of hope that there's some really strong people within those organizations that are really analyzing the situation, not getting caught up in just the glory of being, you know, we're Golf Canada, we're the association, and realizing that there is a tremendous amount of work that still needs to be done. And you know what? They're rolling up their sleeves to do it. And so kudos to them, birdie to both of them and to anybody involved in that process. And we'll hear more about it in the next little while, but it's just refreshing for me to see, and not to say that other people haven't been involved and done that before within the organization, but I think there always has to be people being proactive about pushing forward, and they certainly are.
I love that. That's called a tease right there. You were going to hear about that more, but Scotty's fired up. So I'm fired up for that. That's awesome. Well, that was the week that was, as per usual. We just kind of break down some stories we liked and we didn't like and we are a little unsure about. So we'll be hitting those every single week as per usual. All right, Scotty, it's time to hit our interview this week. Who do we have on the podcast this week?
Well, we're joined today by Barry Forth, who's the general manager of the Copetown Woods Golf Club down near Hamilton, Ontario. We're going to talk about the modern golf club, the modern public golf course, and what facilities can be doing to make the experience better for all their customers, and the creative ways that Barry and his team are going about running their business.
All right, folks, we'd like to welcome to the podcast Barry Forth from Copetown Woods. How are you doing today, Barry?
I'm great. I'm great. Beautiful October day.
It is. And that must feel great as a operator of a golf course. How's the tee sheet looking today?
T-sheets are actually quite good today. We've got some unique things going on today and tomorrow. We've started our aeration process today, actually. So we've only got 9 holes open, but we've got the other 9 completely full and pretty much sold out today. But yeah, October is it's kind of that month where you see the light at the end of the tunnel after a long season and you can't wait to maybe start sleeping in. And by January, we're all going to be kind of clamoring, waiting and wondering where everybody is being lonely.
I love that. First off, though, why don't we sort of lay it out for people what Copetown Woods is, where it is, and maybe your history with the facility?
Sure. Yeah. So Copetown Woods, family owned and operated. So I grew up on this property. My dad was a broccoli farmer. So he farmed 500 acres of broccoli. I grew up right across the road. We farmed this piece of property that I kind of currently sitting on where the golf course sits on in 2002. We had our first dozer on the ground April 1st. By June 2nd, 2003, we had the golf course open, clubhouse open, everything going. Property wasn't conducive to growing vegetables. Just never yielded a great crop. Really inconsistent in terms of soil type. A lot of sandy soil, which not great for growing vegetables, but great for drainage, especially when you have a year like we've had with as much rain as we've had. It drains extremely well. So we're Copetown, Ontario, located. We're part of the greater city of Hamilton. But if you take a triangle from Hamilton, Brantford, Cambridge, we're kind of almost smack dab right in the middle of that triangle.
I love it. And great golf course. Now, why don't you just give a quick breakdown of what the facilities are, and then we'll get into why we're having you on this podcast today.
Sure. Yeah. So when we opened, we built a Victorian style clubhouse. My parents, they traveled the couple of years leading up, kind of up and down the coast and through Georgia and the Carolinas, and kind of brought back a Victorian style feel, kind of Georgian-esque, I guess you could say, with the board and batten look and dormers. And we've got this a beautiful clubhouse. We do a fair amount of weddings. Obviously the last year and a half hasn't been great for that, but typically we would run, 30 to 36 weddings a year. We put on a great patio last year, which is kind of something we can get into we've never had the patio that we have now, which we kind of question ourselves as to why we never did that when we first opened, but 18 holes, fully public facility. We don't have any members at all. When we first opened the golf course, prior to opening, I said to my dad, I was like 23 at the time, and I said, so what are we going to do? Are we going to go public, private, semi-private? And he looked at me with a straight face and said, I've run my business for 30 years and I've made enough money to build this with nobody telling me what to do. And I'm not about to start. and so here we sit today, still with no members, a lot of loyal, you know, pre-purchase package buyers. But that's pretty much the extent of it.
I love that. I love that, because I think golf, you know, personally, and it's going to get into why we're having you on today, is it needs to be more accessible. And the reason why your name was brought to my attention is I had a tweet a few weeks ago, and it was about this private golf course that their fees are going up 25% for members without any kind of recollection or recognition is the right word of where those fees are going. They highlighted how they're actually cutting costs by removing some bunkers. They had highlighted actually how they made a bunch of profit throughout the lockdown year, and they didn't know how to actually put that back into the club, and they were looking for suggestions, and here they are bringing their fees up 25%. And as a, you know, a golf operator, golf owner of a course, right? Like the cost of golf, you know, is going up for a lot of places. And I want to know your opinion on why that is taking place. Do you think it's a good thing for the game? Is this something that, you know, how does Copetown Woods design their pricing strategy?
Yeah. So I would say that we don't, you know, kind of back to, you know, being family owned and operated. And when we first opened, you know, a similar conversation, you know, was when we'd never been in golf before. My dad was a farmer. I came from managing privately owned sports facilities, nothing to do with golf at all. This golf course was fully built on common sense, and to this day is run on common sense. And kind of what works for us may not work for the golf course around the corner.
Is that a bumper sticker? Is that available? Built on common sense?
I would tattoo that on my throat if that made all golf, like the whole industry, run on common sense, I would give my throat to the golf industry. That is amazing. Continue. I'm already fired up, Barry.
No, that's all right. So, so we don't operate on budgets. And when I tell people, when I tell people that, they kind of, you know, they're lift an eyebrow, raise an eyebrow. But we don't run on budgets. We don't operate with, you know, any assumptions or forecasts on how many rounds of golf we're going to do next year or you know, the year coming up. We don't provide our superintendent with X amount of dollars to be able to spend. We know that, you know, if you give anybody a certain budget, you give them a certain number of dollars to spend, they're going to spend it. Otherwise, they're going to lose it. In terms of forecasting for revenue, if the parking lot is, if the sun is out, the parking lot better be full. And if it's a terrible rainy day, it's pouring rain, it's not expected that you can make money until we can figure out how to read the forecast better than the weather forecasters, then, you know, we're not going to forecast revenue. And so in terms of pricing structure and how we do it based on our market, based on, you know, where we sit. We sit in a very unique area where to the east of us, we have Burlington, Oakville, Mississauga, Toronto. So our price compared to that, you know, many golf courses, all golf courses, essentially to the east of us, we're cheaper than. So we provide a really good value for those driving from east of where we're located. On the flip side, to the west of us, we're the expensive one. So when you get out into Cambridge, Brantford, and the surrounding areas, you know, southwest of here, we're one of the more expensive places. And so we just kind of have to find that balancing act between the two of, you know, where do we fit in, where we can still provide a really good golf course for a pretty good price for the people that are, you know, coming from west here, but we're that real good value option for everybody coming from the Mississauga, Oakville, Burlington area, which we get a ton of traffic from. And I would say kind of a majority of traffic comes from there and obviously within the Hamilton region. So, well, we price it based on, you know, where we're located. You know, we don't really necessarily price it on, you know, we had a crappy year last year, we had a really good this year, you know, year this year, or in the current situation that we're in right now. If we wanted to, I'm confident we could fill our tee sheets with supply and demand if we upped our green fees $10. We're not going to, we won't do that. This past year, we increased our green fees $2. That was the first increase that we had done, I think in like 5 years or something like that. Our green fees, just for clarity, walking green fees, 59 during the week, 69 on weekends. That's the peak rate that we get to. We have some kind of off-peak rates that we that get a little bit cheaper than that, but that's the most expensive you're going to get to walk. And so we don't base it on anything other than where we feel comfortable in the marketplace, where we're not going to look at as gouging. We're not going to look at as though we're, you know, we're too cheap. We're, it's a kind of a feeling out process with the golfers.
Now, when you talk about not having, you know, forecasts and budgets and all that, right? Like you hear, you would have some standard businessmen and women blowing their heads, right? They'd be like, what do you like? How can you even guarantee profits? Or they might even challenge you on the other end, right? Is this a business or is this a toy for you to, you know, hey, it's our golf course. So we don't care if we make money or not. You didn't say that, right? You obviously care about making money. It's just doing it through common sense. So like, what would you say to those, I guess, contrarians that say, you know, you don't know what you're doing and how you're actually running a business when we have all this history of how golf courses should be running? You should be increasing your fees 25%, not $2.
Yeah. And I think if they were to kind of come in and see the day-to-day operation and how we manage our business and how we manage our labor and, you know, on a day where it's maybe not going to be quite as busy, you know, we do reduce the number of staff that we have in place, and we, you know, we match our food costs. You know, our chef he's responsible to make sure that, you know, just because we're dealing with one food supplier doesn't mean we just kind of turn a blind eye to what other food suppliers may be charging. So everything has its checks and balances. So saying that we don't budget doesn't mean that we don't pay attention to what we're doing. You know, my dad still has, you know, I'm managing and kind of, you know, managing the business from a day-to-day standpoint, but he is still managing. He looks at every single invoice. When we get a shipment in, if we were to get, you know, a shipment of 24 dozen Pro Vs that comes in from a Acushnet, that packing slip needs to have the date written on it, the price you were quoted written on it, and that needs to be stapled and attached to the invoice when it comes in. Those two match up. If those two don't match up, then somebody hasn't done their job right, whether it's us or whether it's them. And if we need to push back on the supplier, we push back on the supplier. So it's saving the pennies puts dollars in the bank. And at the end of the day, we are a business. I think that's one thing where I would say a lot of public golf falls into a little bit of an interesting category that I run into this problem every once in a while, where people think that because we're a public golf course, we're almost treated as though, or felt maybe as though it's municipal, where we need to do something to give back, or we need to discount more, or we need to do this or that. And, you know, to be able to help them out specifically and not be able to, you know, provide the best experience we can for the most amount of people, because at the end of the day, my job is to fill the parking lot. And yeah, we're here to make we're here to make money, really, at the end of the day. And we're not shy. I'm not shy about telling people that.
Yeah. And you make money by providing an experience, right? People come out to play golf and they need to be having a good experience. And that might and probably should be not in line with how they actually shoot on the golf course, though you could argue that, but that's not necessarily what you're in right now. The golf course is designed in the way it is and players are who they are, right? So when we're talking about making money through that experience being first and foremost, my worry right now, though, is, as I mentioned off the top, these golf courses, like this private golf course going up 25%, where the experience does not change. So why am I paying 25% more for literally the exact experience I got last year, when I know for a fact, maybe you can argue different, costs have not gone up 25%. So I guess my question to you is, we've seen this trend happen in golf before, where golf became the popular sport. Everyone played it, and then a complete jump off a cliff. And now people are discounting rates at alarming dollars, and companies like, say, Golf Now are created to help out with those type of things. So like, how are you planning for this, where there's no guarantee that the increase in participation in golf is going to continue? So where's your head at? I know I haven't really asked a good question here. It's more of a thought of a bunch of information, but like, where's your head at with the prices of golf going up, but nothing really actually changing in the experience that customers are being provided?
Yeah. And I think that we as golf course owners and operators are in the best spot we could possibly ever be. And, you know, I talked to a bunch of different golf course operators, and I think there's a bunch of us that are kind of singing from the same hymn book, as if to say, don't get greedy now. And, you know, the demand that we've seen, the surge in demand that we've seen, we haven't seen any drop off here. I mean, we take, we're 14 day advance bookings, and typically by 10 to 12 days out, we're sold out. So we're going into, there hasn't been one week this year where I'm going into a week, you know, where I, you know, look at the tee sheet Sunday night, kind of coming in Monday, that we typically have no tee times available all week. That's a good problem to have. It's a good, you know, the most consistent conversation I have with golfers is they're mad because they can't get a tee time. But we don't do, we're not running tournaments. We're not running leagues. We're just straight up tee times. So the hope, my hope would be that golf course owners and operators don't get greedy. There are costs, you know, that have definitely increased. Staffing has gone up. Minimum wage has gone up. That, you know, that at a, from a golf course standpoint, that is a fairly significant number by the time you start, you know, going across the board between your back shop turf, you know, all your kitchen, your, you know, the food and beverage front and back of house staff, how things are going to work out for the hospitality side of things and the F&B side, will be interesting next year. This year has been a real struggle with just finding staff. Now next year without the government programs, you know, if they don't keep them going, which who knows at this point if they will or not, I assume they won't, but it's made a made for a real tricky spot for us to be able to get to, you know, to get employees. So costs have gone up, but depending on what it is for us, if those are those costs are going up on the food and beverage side of it, that will be reflected within the price of food, you know, not necessarily within the green fee price. And so, again, you know, we could have a year where we could open, you know, this season we opened in March. We had 4 weeks before the government mandated us to shut down. We don't open the golf course until it's ready to be open. And, you know, we weren't getting greedy and beating it up. But the golf course came out of the spring really, really good this year. And so we had 4 weeks. We shut down for 4 weeks. Now we're back going. Who knows? We could go to mid-November. We could go to October 31st. We have no idea. But in terms of, you know, I think I feel like a lot of people are on the same page to not push the envelope too far, to not get into the situation that you talked about before where the, you know, the boom in the 90s came out, and then, you know, Golf Now's and the likes came in to try and, you know, bail some golf courses out to be able to fill their tee sheet. And that, honestly, that continued on for a number of years. That continued on even here up until I came back, and until I basically came in and said pre-COVID and said, like, no, like, I'm going to work to fill my tee sheet instead of just hand everything over to a place like Golf Now, who just kills the golf industry. It lowers the average green fee price down, and it trains golfers in, you know, to do the wrong thing of go there first instead of coming to the golf course website to be able to book your tee time. So that's a really long winded way to say, I hope that golf courses don't get greedy. I don't think they will. I really don't feel from the conversations I've had with different operators. But the ones that do will get hurt. I feel like golfers have a long memory. Golfers have a long memory, and except for their score, they'll forget their score on after every hole, but they'll remember the golf courses that have gouged and have just kind of taken advantage of the situation that we're in, and taking it outside the golf industry too. There's a lot of industries and a lot of businesses that have suffered immensely. For us to be that greedy, for any golf course to be that greedy, to be able to try and take full advantage of this is doing the absolute wrong thing.
100%. You know, a question regarding, you know, the highs and lows of the industry, and, you know, you obviously, you know, talked about a little bit there of the pace of the industry and how it's gone. But, you know, one thing I guess that you've been very positive about is creating an aspirational message for people to come and play Coketown Woods, and for it not to be about the pricing. You know, what are the elements there? And I guess a lot of it probably leans back into your marketing expertise and experience. But what are the elements do you think that, you know, are important for you as a club and other clubs as well to make sure that they're always in front of the consumer?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I've tried to do since, you know, coming back to the golf course and coming back I say that what I spent 7 years from 2013 to 19 at Wasserman, a global sports marketing agency, and managing all different types of events and, you know, including managing RBC's golf portfolio for the last 4 years I was there, and all the player deals and all the stuff that they, that was surrounded that. And from a kind of an outsider looking in and being a family owned golf course, and I live in Dundas, so I only live 10 minutes away from the golf course. Looking at it, you know, as somebody that came in and played it, you know, I maybe only played it once or twice a year, but if I brought my boys up to use the range, or we went up to, you know, to my dad's house for dinner, and looking at it of, you know, okay, from an experience standpoint, from a hospitality and entertainment standpoint, take the word golf out of it and golf course out of it. What is the experience come, you know, like when you walk through the doors? What is the experience like when you go onto their social media profile and social media pages? And what is that? What does it look like? How are they presenting themselves to you? And that was one big thing I wanted to change when I came back, was basically taking the elevating. The first thing I said to my dad when I came back is, it's my goal to elevate the profile of Copetown Woods and to take it to another level of the experience, not only for the golfers and people that are coming in to eat, but also for the all of the employees. And the one thing that I found when I came here, when I wasn't working here, is that it was boring, to be honest with you. It was boring as hell. Like, the staff were boring. Most people look like they just kind of didn't want to be here. The golf course has always been great. The facilities have always been great. And you could build the nicest golf course in the world, and you can have the best clubhouse in the world, but if you don't have the right people, none of it means anything, because people are going to come, they're going to realize this place is boring, or the staff are rude, or whatever it might be, and they're not going to come back. And so in doing that, one thing I wanted to do, and it helps when it's obviously a family, you know, a family venture, and I've got a vested interest in it. That said, I don't think I'd be much different if it wasn't, you know, if I wasn't working for somebody else. But, you know, I wanted to humanize things a little bit. I've put my face out there, which, you know, isn't probably the best thing in the world.
That was the best option. Have other options, eh?
I've thought about it. The thought about like having a stand-in for me, doing voiceovers, but it didn't work. But just having, you know, humanizing everything, and coming from the sports marketing world for 7 years, it makes me cringe saying the word culture. But when you go and you work at a sports marketing agency, downtown Toronto, we're working, you know, in the financial district, and we're rolling in Converse and jeans and t-shirts while, you know, the suits of Bay Street are in the elevator with us. But that culture, the feeling that the everybody gets when they come in, they're excited to go to work. You enjoy your job, you enjoy the people you work with, and in doing so, you put a better effort into it. And that's what I wanted to bring back. And so, you know, I think that we've done a real good job in the last 2 years. It all started also, you know, as well with bringing kind of the right management team into place. So we've got an amazing chef. We've got an awesome food and beverage manager, catering manager, superintendent, that if, you know, that comes from me to them and down to their employees. You know, when you're in a small business like this, everything starts from the bottom up. And so if you're, you know, your back shop employees and your dishwashers are loving it and having fun, it makes everybody else's job easier. And so that's one of the real big changes, you know, and from the golfer's experience when they come in too, I've changed it up here where it was almost a little stuffy when it didn't need to be. I mean, we're a public golf course that charges $59 during the week. We didn't build this golf course. We didn't spend $30 million to build this golf course to make it the best golf course in Ontario. We didn't make it the best golf course. We didn't try to make it the best golf course in Southern Ontario. We've made this golf course for the market that we're in. We built it on our farmland, and, you know, we want golfers to come in and enjoy themselves, but it's a public golf course. So, you know, when you come in to play and you tee off and you come in to check in the golf shop, my office is kind of sits within the golf shop. It's not, "Oh, Mr. McLeod, welcome to Copetown Woods. Thanks for coming. Enjoy your first, enjoy your round," and blah, blah, blah. It's, "Scott, how you doing, man? Great to see you. Hey, remember OB right at the first hole? If you lose a sleeve, come back in after two, I'll get you." Like, that's the conversation that is easier for me to say than other people, but it's that kind of more fun, loose, casual atmosphere that a lot of people love.
Love it.
You're making me, you're describing my dream golf course right now. but I have a few more questions to get to fully win me over, but I think I know the answers before I get there. I think you nailed it right at the start, is that I've said on this podcast before, you actually don't work in the golf industry. You work in the customer service industry, and the product you're selling is golf. And I think a lot of people in the golf industry haven't ever realized that. I would say your experience is more than 50% of going into any pro shop, and it's this stuffy, you know, oh, you're a problem that I even have to type your, put in a debit machine so you can tap your card to pay for here, right? It's not the opposite, where you're starting with the customer and everything else goes from there. So my final question, really, to make sure this might be one of my favorite golf courses in the world, is what is your opinion on dress code? This comes up a lot. You know, certain private clubs, you know, you can't wear your socks past a certain height, or, you know, you can't have a certain logo on your hat, or anything along those lines. So, you know, you're a public golf course. What's your opinion on dress code at a golf course? Should there be one? Should it be relaxed? What's Copetown Wood's opinion of it?
So I think you'd probably find me in the middle of, you know, if you go, you know, socks up to your knees on one side, and you go, you know, Daisy Dukes Daisy Dukes on guys on the other side, I think you can kind of find me in the middle. So we don't necessarily have a set dress code. If somebody comes in and they are presentable, yes. Like, if somebody comes in and they're, and this was a real conversation that happened last year. Again, you know, in years past, a little, you know, again, call it stuffy. It wasn't really stuffy, but that's the term I'm using. And a guy came in last year that had jeans on. So they were like dark jeans, like nice jeans, looked good. You know, he's a guy that could walk out of here and go into a nice restaurant and have dinner sitting in a nice restaurant. Nobody would turn a blind eye. And that was a question that was posed to me of, well, he's wearing jeans. I'm like, yeah, but they're nice. Like, it's not, they're not ripped jeans. He doesn't look like, you know, he doesn't look like a bum. And then another person came in not long after, that was wearing jeans that were, I think they had more pleats wearing khakis that had more pleats in them than Freddie Couples in the 90s. And they were big, baggy, the big old golf shirt. Like, he's borrowed this, you know, this outfit off of his dad. He's probably never golfed before. Everything's untucked, and he just looks unkempt. So put those two side by each, and who would you rather, you know, now you don't need to compare that, but that's kind of, that was my comparison, you know, at this time. And that was, and these two gentlemen walked in literally like 10 minutes apart. We're, again, right in the middle, where you don't need to have a collared shirt and, you know, and khakis to play golf. If you look, if you're presented well, I'm saying this out loud, and I'm kind of almost half struggling by saying this because I don't really think it matters at all. I really don't. Like, I think it's kind of dumb, because at the end of the day, if people are going to come, they're going to enjoy the place. And if they, once they come and they see and they know the place that they're coming to, most of those people aren't going to, not going to dress like bums anyway. Right. So, you know, I may be doing, if I'm getting guys coming in at Daisy Dukes, then I'm marketing to the wrong people.
I mean, I think we're aligned in that it does matter. At times it does matter where you're at, but I think at the end of the day, it's like, how are you acting on the golf course that matters the most? Are you ruining someone else's experience? And my argument is, if somebody else looks like on the golf course, and I'll even go to Daisy Duke level, if they're whatever they're wearing is ruining your experience somehow, then you care about too many of the wrong things. If how they're playing out there and how they're keeping up the golf course is ruining your experience, then I'm all for it. Like, let's talk about that. One of my favorite rounds this year, I played in a six-some at a 9-hole course. We didn't slow down the golf course at all. We were all in like basketball jerseys, and nobody cared, right? It was just like fun, but like, hey, we kept the course, fixed our divots, and moved along. The people that we had to let through because we were playing in a six-some because the pro let us do it, we let through, and nobody cared because that was that golf course. I understand that doesn't work everywhere, but I don't think it was our clothes that had any part of the issue.
No, and you know, I mean that, and then you know getting into the six-some. There's been many times this year where we've had, you know, let's just say it was two people, you know, two foursomes get booked by the same person and they end up with five, or they just book as five. It's in my best interest from a golf course to, you know, from a yield management standpoint, if I can put them together as a five, that opens up a foursome spot for me. Now, that's not being greedy, but if I can make that, have that conversation and basically say to that, you know, that fivesome, who would more enjoy playing as five than as two with two strangers or three with a single stranger, guess, you know what? Hey, go out as five. Just keep up with the group in front of you. It matters nothing of what's going on behind you. The group behind you will have nothing to complain about if you keep up with the group in front of you. That's all you have to do. That's all every golfer, every foursome, every group that goes out, the only thing you need to do is keep up with the group in front of you. And if you do that and everybody follows suit, we're going to play in 4 hours, no matter how many golfers are in your group. And that's one thing that has been, it's funny that there are golfers that they'll be three holes over playing behind them and be appalled that there is a fivesome on the golf course. Yeah, there is. There's actually, and then it's like, and you know what? And like three groups behind them, there's seven playing together, which they're not. I just say that to see what they would do. And they're like, and they can't even believe it. It's which is hilarious. So
and there's a guy at dinner. He's eating by himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. People just, they worry about things that don't matter, right? It's these mundane things. I love that answer. Scotty's got a question for you though.
Yeah. I was just going to say, obviously you mentioned some things, people are used to certain things being conventional, I guess, and they get used to that. So they assume that's the way it needs to be, but you know, let's look ahead a little bit. I mean, you're doing a lot of great things. As you said, common sense is your North Star versus anything else. But that said, you know, where do you think the public golf space needs to be going as we look forward to be as viable as possible for clubs to compete, to get people's attention, but to also, you know, satisfy what their needs are? Are there things that you're looking ahead for your facility that, you know, might be a good addition for the future?
Yeah, I think the one big thing, obviously, is currently kind of as things as we stand right now. And I don't really foresee next year being much different, where as long as we can continue to provide a good experience at a good value, our t-shirts are going to be full. So, you know, to go out and, you know, kind of take out the ideas that I always kind of keep hitting in my back pocket. We'll keep those ones for, you know, when maybe the demand kind of slows a little bit. But being unique and different and doing different things, like, I mean, we've had to kind of read and react as every business has, you know, throughout the COVID, the last 18 months for COVID. But I mean, when we were closed in the spring, we ran picnics because you could have takeout and you could experience. So you could go and you could walk municipal golf courses, City of Hamilton municipal golf courses. You could go and walk them as green space. So I said to our chef, okay, we can, you know, let people walk in our pick up takeout and then they can go and walk on the golf course. So we had picnics that we sold like 1500 picnic goer. We had 1500 picnic goers in 2 weekends. And then shockingly, Mr. Ford reopened golf courses on the holiday weekend. But it's just being, it's different things, just doing different things like that, where it's take the template out of the equation, figure out what works best for you. And like I said, what works for us may not work for the golf course around the corner. And you know, one of the big things that we're doing too is partnering with as many local different businesses as we can as well. And, you know, beer partnerships with local brewery and basically, you know, kind of driving business to each other and creating those kind of cool experiences where I can send people there and they can send people here and we can kind of make some good things happen. But at the end of the day, we're co-marketing and we're, you know, I'm letting somebody else sell for me and I'm kind of in turn selling for them. And so, you know, the other thing I would say is transparency, that there's not a lot of in the golf industry of what people are doing, what you're doing. And it's not necessarily like from a you know, an agronomy standpoint of telling people how you're mowing greens or this or that. It's, you know, we're aerating our golf course today and tomorrow. So today and tomorrow, while we're keeping nine holes closed, I did a thing today and tomorrow where $25 includes a cart, come out nine holes only. We're going off the front tees only, just for no reason other than because it's fun. And we're putting all the pins in tucked positions. So we're going hard pins, front tees, and people that have gone out and just only played nine holes today, they're coming back in and like, oh my God, like this was so fun. Can we get out for another nine? And we're literally turning people away because we have no tee times. And so it's doing things like that is scrapping everything that the golf industry thinks should happen, and just doing something completely different. Cause you know what, who cares? Like, it's just fun.
Barry, I've been talking on this podcast on my golf game. I've been hating it. I've been trying to struggle if I want to go play golf, but I'm falling in love with golf just from hearing what you're doing at your golf course. It sounds fun. It sounds different. It's like, this is what I've been preaching on this podcast. Let's stop. Golf doesn't need to be stiffy and stuffy. And if you want to play at your $50,000 a year golf course because you got that money and you want it to be that way, sure, whatever, then be that way. But for the rest of us, this is how we're actually going to grow the game. And I love that you're like, hey, I got all these other ideas when golf, you know, dries up a little bit and I got to get people out here. And things like this is such a cool idea. 9 holes, put the pins in weird spots, but you got the tees up there. Like, that sounds so much fun. I love these ideas. It's different thinking. I can't wait. I need to get to Copetown Woods ASAP. We really appreciate you coming on. Any final thoughts before we wrap up the podcast?
No, I don't think so. And I think, you know, kudos to you guys, because having conversations like this open the world up to new golfers, and to golfers kind of trying to figure out, you know, what the hell the golf world is turning into and where things are going to go. And so thanks to you guys for kind of, you know, making giving kind of a soapbox to help the golf industry, because golf courses are only one piece of the industry, and you guys are just as much just as big of a part of it. So
all right, Scott, let's hit some recent news coming out of golf. We hit the week that was. Not much really coming out right now. You said you saw some equipment sneaks. Nothing we can really get into. I know you've probably seen them. You're probably under some sort of embargo of some sort. What are you seeing? You said you saw some trademarks coming out. What do you?
Yeah, I tend to pay attention to patents and trademarks. And the thing about looking at things like trademarks and patents is that it doesn't necessarily guarantee a timeline. So a company could apply for a trademark this year, and it could be something that they're not going to use for a couple of years, or they might not use at all. So in this case, I was having a look through TaylorMade's listing in their trademarks, and it looks like back in June and July, they applied for some trademarks regarding clubs and other elements with the terms carbon wood, matrix wood, fuse, and stealth. So we'll see if those come up. I haven't seen anything yet as far as products for 2022 for TaylorMade, but I'm sure at some point we will. So, hey, it's we'll roll the dice and we'll see if something like that shows up.
Yeah, you probably find those trademarks and things. Golf WX always has those in the forums. You get deep in
sometimes,
there.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, until they get shut down and somebody complains, reports it because they shouldn't have got them out. But yeah, that's pretty cool. The other thing that was kind of announced, there's not too much really news wise that I can really think of, but I did see the RNA and the USGA announced this. Oh, we have two different things. You had the one about this local rule option for club limit. Okay, I didn't see this one. I was going to talk about a different one. Give me quick rundown on this one.
Yeah, so the RNA and USGA basically announced today that there'll be a new local rule option for club limit, which is the limit in the length of 46 inches.
Okay, never mind. I thought you meant the amount of clubs in your bag.
No, that's what I was going to talk about.
Same thing. Yeah,
Okay. So basically, it's an option effective January 1st, 2022. PGA Tour says they will adopt this. It's really targeted at elite amateur competitions and professional competitions. The tour says it still has to be approved by their player council, but this is something that they're looking at adopting for next year, and that the fact that there'll be a limit of 46 inches for their players. I don't know if it's really, you know, it's not really much. I mean, if they looked at, even in the PGA Tour's own press release, they talked about the fact that very few, if any, players play with a driver over that length anyways. So I think this is just trying to be somewhat proactive. But again, if we look at it relative to amateur golfers, last time I saw an amateur golfer with a driver over 46 inches was about never.
I haven't had a driver over 45 inches ever. Yeah. I think I like it. Right. So why, you know, like there's so many other rules that could be changing, and it feels like everything's about this distance and it's I'm so over it. It feels just so ass backwards to me. Yeah. Where I don't get it. I just don't get it. Like, there's so many other rules that you could potentially change that would make golf better, but more fun regardless. But and this one, like, why wouldn't they go with the putter first? Like, well, what if we start with the putter couldn't be over 38 inches? I would rather that.
Well, that's the thing. This whole rule basically, does not include the putter as far as the length is concerned. So, but again, do we want that one for the putter? I mean, really?
I would rather the putter. I would rather get rid of the arm lock on the putter, or even on top of that, maybe even just make it shorter so you can't even arm lock the putter, right? Yeah. Like, unless you get on your knees to putt. But like, I don't think people can even do that. I'm sure you could, but you couldn't put a towel down, right? Like, right. Like, there's so many dumb things. Like, It just doesn't make sense. I think there's other rules. Yeah. I think
it plays into their distance insight study and discussing that as far as the potential ways that players could creep up as far as distances are concerned. But, again, this affects so few people that I think it's just more of an afterthought. I don't think it's really anything that's significant. And again, I think it was something that was meant to come out at an earlier standpoint. And really, it's really just it's just a little mark on the side. It's not something that's really significant.
I agree. If you had to change one rule though, or make a rule, just one that you wish they spending some time on that instead of this, what rule would that have been?
Probably the anchoring rule, really, in essence. Excuse me. I'm choking,
so upset
on it.
By it.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a distinct advantage in a lot of the cases for some of the things that are happening. And, if they were going to do a local rule option, make the anchoring a putter option just for the tour or for elite amateurs, the way this rule is being put into play. And, for a lot of the other golfers that are just casual players, just let them putt whatever way that they want. And really, I think it's about being inclusive. I mean, the USGA and the RNA obviously, beat the drum about being inclusive. But we want people to play the game. And the fact that, they've got to throw out their rounds or they're not legal rounds if they're putting in these other ways that are not described. I think that's the one that I think they may be tripped over a little bit.
Yeah, I agree with that one. I think the other one that I would do, but I know it'd be impossible. It's never actually going to happen. I think the whole, if you're in a divot in the fairway, why can't we get out of those things? But I know it's going to be subjective. Yeah, but if I'm waving a magic wand at it, we're talking about making it better than give me that one. And then again, you're talking about it. There's different rules for the pros versus amateurs, right? Like, as an amateur, you get to do that. But as a pro, you don't. I mean, how many times do you hit a divot in a fun round with your friends, even if you're playing for $50, right? Like, I'm going to take out the divot. Yeah, no problem. Right. But you play in an amateur tournament, like Flagstaff Open, I got a divot that some dingus didn't fix. And now I got to play out of it. Right. Like, just frustrating, but
and it's probably come up more this year with the increase in play. And that rule tends to come up a little bit more when there have been big increases in play. And we saw that again in the 1990s when, the game was getting a little bit more popular. Courses in certain areas will get beat up and there will be more divots there. So that's when the topics tends to rise up a little bit more. But again, as you mentioned, it's going to be really subjective, and, having to call someone over all the time and go, oh, is this in a divot? Can I move this? Whatever. Yeah. That just adds another complication as far as time is concerned. But as you said, wave your magic wand and get what you get.
Now it's got me thinking, if we're going crazy, what'd be fun is a tournament, an amateur tournament. Maybe Flagstaff Open should do this one year. You only get to bring 10 clubs, right? And do something like that, right? Why not? That could be a different type of thing that you could do versus 14. When did we settle on 14?
It used to be unlimited. It used to be the other way. And then it started to go down. But I mean, I saw a guy, and I think I mentioned on the show, I saw a guy playing the McKenzie Tour this year that had, eight clubs in his bag. Unfortunately, it didn't help him much. He shot 90.
Sounds like he should have had unlimited, but
he needed more. That's for sure. But I think those are fun for a certain situation anyways. In companies like Mura has sold with Linksoul, they did a partnership and had a limited club set. I've heard of other companies that are actually looking at doing that as well. in essence, you know, Lauren Rubenstein, one of our greatest Canadian writers, I mean, he plays with a half set all the time. If you see with Lauren with a full set, I doubt it. You'll rarely ever see it. It's a fun way to play. And I think you're right. From a creativity standpoint, it's good, but I just don't know if we need to put everybody in a box all the time, especially for recreational play.
Yeah.
I think we need to let them do a little bit more of what they want. And I get it. You're trying to equate them, especially when you're talking about the handicap system, but people shouldn't feel dirty and bad because they want to play golf kind of their own way a little bit.
Yeah. Right now, because I'm waiting on my other half of my combo set.
Yeah.
I have my three wedges. So my lob wedge to my gap wedge. And then my next iron is my five iron. I don't know if I'm playing at all
that's a tough way to play.
But we got some gaps here that we could get interesting if I do get out in the next couple of weeks and those irons don't hit show up. So yeah, silly rule change. I thought when we're talking club limit, I thought they made some sort of limit where it's like, sir, we have a local rule here. You're only allowed 10 clubs. You're going to put the other four in your car. That would have been fun. I was like, when did this happen? Cause that's crazy. And that would be going viral. But maybe next week.
You never know.
All right. Let's hit the mailbag, Scotty.
Let's get to it. All right. A bunch in here this week. And I asked for everything from the serious, the fun, to the ridiculous, to the hypothetical. And, you know, we're going to start off with a fun one here. The question is, turkey, white meat or dark meat? And how do you eat the leftovers?
I'm both with the white or dark meat. It also just depends on how they cook it, right? Because if it's the white meat can get dried out so quickly with a turkey that the dark meat ends up being a little bit more tender. But I was watching a lot of Food Network on the weekend, watching some sort of Thanksgiving showdown or something, some sort of like chops. And apparently the lot of butter under the skin is the way to keep it nice and moist. But my experience is there's nothing better than a smoked turkey. Then it's cooked to perfection. So that's my white or dark meat. What about you?
I'm usually, or I have been the last bunch of years, been white meat. I actually had a turkey leg this year, which was great. Hadn't had that in a while.
Eat it like with your hand, like you're.
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah, a little caveman action or whatever. And whatever it is, it's going to have a little bit of gravy on it for sure. But white meat for the last bunch of years, but dark meat this year. And as far as leftovers are concerned, I'm a big breakfast the next day. Turkey sandwich with cranberry on it.
No, cranberry can't do it. Can't do that. I don't do sweet and savory, man. I don't do it. My move is, and I've done it once, so it's not really my move, but I saw a couple things is you take all the leftovers, like the turkey and any other, say you got leftover carrots. So you got whatever left in the fridge,
potatoes, and you make a
shepherd's pie out of that.
Nice.
You throw that in, you got the leftover mash right there. You throw them over top, get that in the oven. Nice little bake, throw some cheese on top of that. You'll be happy.
Move. That's a solid move and a good way to use it all up because, you know, what ends up happening is that, you know, eat one or two pieces and then you look in the fridge and you're like, man, I can't eat any more turkey. But if you do that, that's good. I like that one. I'd definitely give that one a whirl for sure. All right. Someone asked, do you see golf continuing to grow at the rapid rate it once was, or it is once we're out of the pandemic?
It can't. It just can't grow any further. So no, I don't. I only see it flattening and then going down because more options are going to come up and, you know, that concert's going to come up and everything else that people would do and do in person or, you know, I'm like, for example, my old men's league hockey team that's back up and running. Like sports are coming back, right? As long as you're showing your vaccination for a lot of things, you can pretty much live normally now with that. So no, I don't see it happening. And I think golf courses need to start getting creative to keep that, that going.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. You know, I think we've talked a little bit about it on the show here too. You know, the rapid rate, it's not going to continue. We've had a great opportunity to introduce a lot of people to the game. They're obviously going to choose what level that they're going to stay involved with the game. So I think the growth will be somewhat sustained, but we're certainly going to lose a few people as they return back to the normal activities. But I think the big thing is as an industry trying to, you know, look at those new golfers and how they've come in and using them as ambassadors as well to be excited about the game and maybe share the game because, you know, maybe the people that have been hanging around in the industry for a while haven't really been sharing it as much. So there's a good opportunity there to provide some growth for the game. So, all right. What's the most annoying thing you witnessed on the driving range besides a man jumping while he tries to hit a ball? No, I just put that last part in there. But,
that wasn't part of the question. Eh?
No. What's the most annoying thing you witnessed on the driving range?
I don't remember where I was, but some guy just came over to me and started giving me advice. And like, I laughed at first because I thought he was joking and I thought maybe I knew him. And then like, I laughed and then looked around and I didn't know him and then started hitting balls. And I literally just had to turn around to him and be like, sir, go away. Like, just leave me alone. I don't care. Like, I literally had to say, I do not care. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
Go away. Go hit your balls. Like, yeah. That's gotta be the most annoying. And then the worst, and I haven't experienced in a while, but like the guy that does that to say the girl that's there, she just wants to hit some golf balls and walk over and tries to give the advice. Like anything where you are giving, it doesn't matter if it's golf or not, unsolicited advice. We all think we can help everybody because everyone has an ego. Just don't do it. Just if you're going to the range, hit your own golf balls, go away. Go away.
Yeah,
that's my thoughts. But what about you? I'm sure you've been on way more ranges than I have.
Yeah, a little blend of that. Obviously, the same thing that you're talking about is an issue. But one of the things that's really funny, and I can't even see myself having done it or being willing to do it. I'll be set up to do a lesson. I'll be up on the range, and you know, my tent set up, my bag is out there, the track man's out, you know, the whole deal. It's pretty clear that I'm probably a golf professional and giving lessons. And then you'll get some dude pulls up with his buddy, and dude is giving his buddy lessons or trying to give his buddy lessons while he's standing next to you. And, you know, God love him. I appreciate the fact that he's trying to help out his friend a little bit.
You're just grinding your teeth.
Yeah. But when all of a sudden every single thing he's telling him is totally wrong and pretty much going to send this person away from the game, that's when it's really starts to grind me a little bit or whatever. And, you know, I'm not the kind that a person that's going to just roll over and, you know, act, you know, Bobby Big Wheel and throw my business card in there and go, hey, if you want a lesson, you know, come see me or whatever. But it's just unfortunate all of a sudden that, you know, somebody that's really trying to get into the game, and that's pretty much falls in line with what you're talking about, is getting all sorts of advice, whether solicited or unsolicited, that's wrong, really wrong. So the best thing that person could do is maybe say, hey, you know what, take you to the driving range, let you experiment and make you aware that, you know, there are lessons available if you do want to, you know, advance your game a little bit, and then maybe wander over to me and get my card.
I love that. I was just thinking, you need to get like a logo tent with your like website on it. I think that's some easy marketing. We need to come up with something good for that tent. We can't just have a red tent out there anymore, Scotty.
Well, sometimes you're already too busy as it is, so you don't need to solicit more business. How's that?
Sometimes you won't even let your friends over.
we'll leave that alone for now. All right. How often should I be practicing in the off season? Maybe that's that guy that was on the driving range. Your thoughts on that?
It's up to what you're trying to do, right? Like, yeah. Are you just trying to have fun? Then I don't know, dude, practice whatever the hell you want. You got some big goals, then work with your professional on how often you should be practicing and what, I mean, it also depends on what you got, right? Like,
yeah,
not everyone has a golf cave like Scotty, right? Like my practice is pretty much just putting in the winter because that's all I got. So, I'm sure how you decide that with your students is different.
Yeah, it really comes down to exactly what you said. It comes down to what their goals are and really what they're trying to achieve. And the off season is a great time to work on big pieces of your golf swing. I mean, really during the season itself, when you're really trying to score and play well in tournaments, you know, you can do a lot of little tweaks and things like that. But if you want to work on big pieces, the off season definitely is the time to do that. That doesn't necessarily mean you need to be practicing. That means you need to be educating yourself during the winter time, maybe going through certain motions, doing certain things. But again, as you said, it really comes down to what you have available as far as a net, an indoor facility, a putting green. So there's not a should. It's more in line with what your goals are more than anything. And you know what, you're going to figure that out. I mean, I get those messages, especially this time of year, people are all of a sudden, you know, looking for a net or whatever, because they've decided that they're going to practice a bunch this winter and they want to hit some balls. Maybe they want to, you know, a lower price launch monitor or something like that. It's really up to the individual, what their goals are, setting some objectives related to that. It could be self-coaching. It could be working with a coach. It really varies more than anything. And I know that's a crappy answer, but that's the reality of it, is that really it is dependent on the person themselves. And they need to decide that with some guidance, maybe from a golf professional.
Do something every single day. I don't know if you can. Sure. At worst, make 3 putts from 3 feet.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You know, the thing is habits, you know, as you know, habits are an important thing. And if you have, and if you want the ability to get better, then obviously you have you have to set some standards of what you want to do. And doing something is better than doing nothing.
Yeah, 100%.
All right. On to our next one here, and sort of related, any thoughts on the personal launch monitors coming onto the market? Foresight, GC3, Bushnell Launch Pro, etc. You want me to tackle that one?
Well, I want you to tackle it more from a technical standpoint, but from my standpoint, I think it's the best thing that we can do, is that the more competition, the more feasible it is to actually get something like this. The more that I can go to a friend's house and they have a launch monitor at their house and a simulator. And like we're looking at potentially building a house in the next year or so. And that's literally the only, like, my wife can choose every single detail if she wants. She can choose the floor, the kitchen. She can choose the whatever. She can choose it. She can choose the concrete that they build the foundation on. As long as there is a spot where over the next couple of years I can build a simulator there, whether it's in the garage or it's in the basement, like, that's all I care about. And now it's become more and more affordable to actually do it. I understand from your standpoint, having a TrackMan is for tons of different reasons, and you're teaching and there's a lot more data you can get there. But for somebody that just might want to play and actually get roughly accurate data without every single piece of data, it's just becoming more and more affordable. So I love that it's happening. Now I don't know all about each one of them, and maybe this is where you can actually break down if it's a good thing or not.
Yeah, I mean, on the lines that you have it there, these are becoming more accessible. I mean, personal is an interesting way to term it. Personal really depends a little bit on budget as well. So when we start to talk about, you know, devices that are, you know, 7,000 US, that may not be for everyone as far as what they're investing, because, you know, on the other side of it too, that's just a launch monitor. They have to build, you know, a place that they're going to hit, put up a screen, projector, laptop, all sorts of different things. So, progressively, this segment of the industry is getting better and better for the consumer. There are more options at lower prices that people can enter into the market. And obviously, if this is their big hobby and this is what they spend their money on and they choose to spend their money on, yeah, we are getting better products out there. And the GC3 basically is a 3-camera Foresight system, different than the Foresight GC Quad. So it is a little bit lower price, has a few less data points, does have some options as far as the simulator is concerned. They have a partnership with Bushnell. Bushnell, their Launch Pro device is pretty much the same thing as the GC3, but they're offering it at a upfront price and then subscription rates. So what happens for a lot of these devices is that either you have subscriptions, so you have costs during the year that you have to pay for licensing for different software. And the Foresight GC3, they sell it as a group up front. It's sort of included. So that's why the price is a little bit higher. The Bushnell Launch Pro is basically the same device. You pay less up front, but you pay higher subscription fees throughout the year. So we're going to see more and more of these. And I would say, you know, in the next 5 years, based on how technology is growing and getting better, costs are getting better as far as how these machines are put together, all the components and parts, it will become more personal and more affordable in the next few years. So basically what I'm saying is that, you know, if they're within your budget and you want to get them now, yeah, there's great stuff out there. I mean, FlightScope Mevo Plus is one that's been out for a couple of years, which provides an option. Is it perfect? No, but it might be perfect enough for you. So I would say for anybody who's really into the game, maybe it's a SkyTrack, whatever the case may be, you can definitely jump into the market. You just have to be committed enough to have enough resources to be able to do it. I just think it's a great thing that more and more of these products are coming because, as you said, not everybody needs a TrackMan or a Foresight GC Quad or a FlightScope Tour. They don't need all the top end stuff that maybe we need as a teacher or somebody that's professional in the industry.
Yeah, and that GC3 is one more camera than what was at once the GC2, one of the better
the GC2. Yeah,
and that was a great software. If that's all I had forever, I'd love that. It ball faded and cut and I could play golf and it roughly when I got out of the winter after hitting all year on it, I knew exactly where the golf ball was going because hey, I saw it. It wasn't perfect. Like spin rates weren't great. I'm sure my driver was going 15 yards further or 15 yards shorter than it actually would, but it doesn't really matter. It's more about that the feel. And that's probably the biggest problem I'm having right now is I'm just not practicing getting on the range enough that it feels like right now every time I go play is that first round of the winter when you haven't done anything, right? And that's every time I go play right now. So, I love it. I can't wait. I hopefully can get a system up in my house in the next couple of years if that ever happens. We'll see.
You might be in the position to, to be ready for a system that's a lot cheaper even by that point. Who knows? So.
Hey, if anybody out there, hey, Foresight, if you want to sponsor the podcast, we would love that. We'll take some of these. We'll test them. We'll talk about them. Whatever you want. I'll sign it in blood. I don't care. Just need one.
All right. On to our next one here. Three questions left, including a secret question that I know nothing about. I'm looking forward to that one. This one came in. How do I stop screwing up my second shot after a perfect drive? Let me tackle this one.
Okay.
Because first thing is that obviously this person is judging their expectations based on the shot before. And that's a problem as it is. And as we know, every single event is separate and expecting the fact that you do hit a perfect drive. And when we say a perfect drive, for a lot of people, that means a perfect result. It doesn't necessarily mean you did everything right. It just ended up where you wanted it to. So that's why it doesn't guarantee what's going to happen next. On the other side of it, people tend to put unreasonable expectations on a lot of things. So the fact is they got the result that they wanted. Their expectation is automatically they're going to have a great result the next time. So that is a big thing as far as personal expectations are concerned. Just because you hit the one shot doesn't mean you're going to hit the next one. You have to deal with that individual situation. And there could be a million factors why you don't hit that shot well, but just don't assume that you hit one well, you're going to hit two well, because I guarantee you, even on the PGA Tour, they are not hitting a highlight reel shot every single time.
Yeah, I was probably going to say the same thing. I was actually joking on Twitter that instead of fairway and regulation, I've actually moved that stat for me to in play and regulation off the tee. Because that's all that matters nowadays. Like, hey, can I find it? Yep. All right. I'm happy. Versus having to take a drop. That just shows how my golf ball industry is. I'm keeping it alive myself.
I love it.
Amount of balls I lose. All right. What's our next one?
All right. This one could be a big one. And I actually joked with Brad Fritch, Korn Ferry Tour winner, who submitted this one on Twitter, that this could be a 7-part series. So let's touch over it lightly, because this could be one that we could actually bring him on and some other players as well to discuss. And it's certainly something that we've touched on a little bit. What's your saturation point for professional golf, specifically the PGA Tour? Obviously, you know, we have a huge, huge schedules now, too many events. And how would fewer events square with getting Korn Ferry Tour grads enough events to get a fair shot at keeping card? Wow. This one may be a whole podcast.
It could be a whole podcast. And I think maybe we could try to do something different, like almost like a journalistic podcast around this topic.
Yeah.
I think for my saturation point, it really, I think I know it already. It's for the whole year. I think I've picked my tournaments just knowing the courses and what we're watching of what I'm going to watch golf. Right. Like, right.
So what you're saying is you're at the level now that you pick out a number of events that basically you just ignore more than anything. And you pay attention to the certain ones you want.
I could not tell you what the name of the event that just played was. I have no idea.
And that's a problem for the PGA Tour, because that's a problem for the sponsor.
Yeah. No idea. And I'm a and I'm a, in quotes, golf journalist. Like that's like, I couldn't come up with it right now. I've put a gun to my head. I probably could like maybe fight through it and figure it out. But right now I'm talking because I'm trying to delay thinking about it. And I can't, the Shriners. There you go. Couldn't think about it. I know where we got, what do we got? CJ or Zozo this week. And I only remember that because we talked about it 2 weeks ago and did that whole thing. But like, I think that's most people, but I also think storylines change that. Now, if Tiger Woods came out next week and played in, say, the Zozo or the CJ, again, I don't know which one's coming out next.
I think it's the CJ, week. And I think I actually rode Zozo in here.
There you go. It, like, that changes that things. I think storylines change things, right? If Sam Burns would have won again this week, and it looked like at one point from checking my leaderboard, he was right in the mix, like, maybe we have a lot of, maybe the whole podcast has changed this week to, do we have a superstar in the making? And I think we could have done that podcast anyway right now, but we're not going to. But that's where my head's at with the PGA Tour. I think I want to see more Korn Ferry Tour stuff available. But the thing is, they're never going to change it. They're on this schedule. It's always going to be there. I think it's your own limitations of what you can take. And I'm sure there's people that watch every single Saturday, Sunday of the PGA Tour every single week because that's their sport. For me, especially right now with the NFL on, I might flip over to it. But like the NFL's taken my Sunday and I'm not. The PGA Tour, unless it's a big event, it's not getting the airtime.
No, and we saw this past weekend. I mean, the tournament was on the Golf Channel. You know, it's not getting on the major networks because
My in-laws don't even have the Golf Channel, so I couldn't have watched it anyway. Yeah,
I was exactly the same situation where I was at. They didn't have the Golf Channel, so you know, I'm watching a little bit of stuff online or whatever. So the saturation point is this one, as you mentioned. You know, from a consumer standpoint, yeah, it's probably too much. There's no breaks that are in there. On the other side of it, the PGA Tour's responsibility is to create as many opportunities as possible for their players. That said, there's too many cards available. So a lot of players can't get in these events. Mm-hmm. So it becomes this big convoluted mess where there's no perfect strategy. But that said, you know, we've already talked about it in this show and where the money goes and so forth. If all these good players that can't get into the PGA Tour events, either they cut down the number of cards or they make the Korn Ferry Tour a truly secondary tour where it has decent level purses. And this was talked about years ago. And this is what created, in essence, the Hogan Tour back in the day, which became this tour, the Nike Tour. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a PGA Tour A and a PGA Tour B. And basically, here's these other level of events that you have this other tour that's, you know, still a place where you can do well and make money, but you're not at the level of the top tour. So we still need spaces for these people to play. So we still have to have tournaments. But on the other side, consumers are not going to always, you know, go with it. So where it's going to come down to, it's going to come down to the sponsors. It's going to come down to, are the sponsors getting the value for their events? And eventually at some point, a sponsor is going to say, you know what? I don't want to be involved for what it's going to cost me. I'm not going to get the return. And once we get to that point, then the PGA Tour starts to really have a problem because they're not going to be able to offer all these tournaments and they're not going to be able to wedge all these people in anywheres. And when we look now at PGA Tour events, you know, fall season events, having $7 million purses, that becomes unaffordable in this climate for a lot of corporations. So this is going to break and fall apart only when there's not enough sponsors to really take care of it more than anything.
Yeah, 100%. And to answer your last question, I don't want to answer that question of balancing the Korn Ferry Tour grads and all that. I think it's a better question to bring Brad on. So let's bring Brad on again and we'll
talk. Yeah, for sure. I love that.
All right. The last question here is I wrote secret question because I didn't want you to read it and then come up with an answer. So a faithful listener sent this in.
Okay.
With Scott's recent success in the Ping Challenge Cup as a captain, do you think Mike Weir should be considering him as an assistant for the President's Cup at Royal Montreal? Do you want me
Shout out to my mom.
Here's my pitch for Mike Weir. I don't think you bring Scott on as a assistant captain, but you do bring Scott on as an associate captain. So he's not making any decisions out there. He doesn't actually have one of those, headsets on. Actually, I think that's the first thing you cannot have Scott have one of those headsets on, because you Mike would be standing there on, say, the 14th tee, and he'd hear in his ear be like, "Hey, Mike, back in 1899, blah, blah, blah." Like, he'd have some fat, and Mike would be like, "Can everyone go to channel 2? Like, he'd have to, like, find a way. It'd just be too much of that. But that guilty. There is a place for that. So, like, at the night, the week of, I think if you bring Scott in earlier in the week, you talk about the tradition of the President's Cup, the tradition of Royal Montreal and all that type of stuff. And then he cooks you wings and steak and all that. Then you have a value there. But let's not let this one win go to his head. It's been a while, I think, since you've gotten a win. I'm not there yet, but 2024 is a few years away, so we could get there. 3 wins in a row, I think you got to take the hot hand. So there's potential, but right now I will sign up for associate guy in the locker room. He's actually not allowed to leave the locker room.
I don't think I can answer it any better than that. So let's just say when you're involved with an event like the Ping Challenge Cup, we get to do the pairings, but just as I've said with the Ryder Cup and everything else, it comes down to the players and how they play.
Yeah, should have heard what he said off air. He was he got in a couple guys' ears. He was given the strategy. It was all him. He was so stoked. He was texting me all day. He's just being humble on the podcast. Don't listen to it. Let's wrap up the mailbag. He's gonna go over in nonsense. Too humble. Don't let it happen.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Thanks, everyone, for sending in your questions, including that secret question. Anyways, keep them coming. Whether we want to talk about turkey or launch monitors or anything else, we're happy to hear your questions. So hit us up on Instagram at T-Talk Podcast. We always ask for the questions there, and keep them coming at us because we enjoy answering them.
Love it. All right, that's it for this episode, but we do got to hit a tip of the week. Scott, you got to get back to recording them, but the cave's a little closed. Did you record this one though, or are we just going?
We'll just give you this one a little manually audio.
All right, let's hear it.
Yeah, you know what? I've been doing a lot of work lately talking about motor skills and acquiring motor skills, and you know, just exploring it more than anything. And one of the key things that people tend to forget is that, you know, the golf swing is a motion that is independent of the golf ball. And generally what happens is that people look for the feedback of making the strike to the golf ball and looking up in the air, and they use that to justify whether they've made a good movement or not, or done what they were supposed to do in their golf swing. Well, really, if you're working with a coach and they're showing you a certain movement pattern, you can teach yourself how to do that without a golf ball. And really, in essence, you should, just so that you are focused on what you're supposed to be doing. So what I would say is, for a lot of people, is they need to ingrain that body motion independent of a ball, or not have a actual golf ball. And the thing is, I'll do it with, you know, I'll have junior players have a larger golf ball, or I have foam golf balls that they can hit. What I'll get players to do is look at their movement pattern they're trying to do a lot of slow golf swings, work through the motion at like 30% speed, 40% speed, just working through the feels and getting what you're trying to do. And, you know, there's a reason why practice swings are really important. So just really, especially this winter, as you start to work on your golf swing, you know, work with your coach on your intention of what you're trying to do, get a feel for what your technique is going to be, work on those movement patterns. And this is the best time of year to do it, especially if you don't have an indoor hitting facility. You can stand up at your desk and work and be one of those crazy guys or girls that are working on their golf swing anywheres, you know, in the middle of Costco, whatever the case may be. Work on those movement patterns without a ball and ingrain it, and you'll be better off by the time the spring comes.
I love it. I love that. Hey, do something every day. That's how we're going to end the podcast. Do something every day. All right, that's it for this podcast. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you to all the subscribers, as per usual. And as I mentioned, we're looking for a sponsor. We'll take Foresight. We'll take anything. We'll take beer. We will do this podcast for beer. We've said that before. And we'll say it again. Let's leave it there. Everyone, I hope you enjoy your final rounds of the year in Ontario. All the people listening in southern states, well, enjoy it all winter long. But that's it for us. Final thoughts, Scotty, before we wrap things up?
No, all good. Looking forward to playing some scrambles in the next little while. So hopefully I can talk maybe about a victory by the end of next week. How's that?
Ooh, I will not be bringing up my last place in our three-man scramble. 3-man scramble. Yeah, we finished minus one.
Wow. Yes. All right. Thanks, everyone. We don't need to hear the breakdown of that one.
Yeah, two under through two, had a bogey, and never had a birdie after that. So there you go.
I know it's getting closer to Halloween, but no horror stories, please.
Yeah, tough one. You hate to see it. All right, we'll leave it at that. We'll see everybody next week. Ciao.